I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back again to the Explaining History podcast. I am joined today by James Baldwin, who is the Professor Emeritus of History at York University. And we are talking today about the history of the song Amazing Grace, which is a slight departure in some ways for the Explaining History podcast. I mean, we'll be talking about the history of all sorts of kind of events and historical processes. But it's rare. I think we've only done it once or twice in the past where we talked about the kind of the cultural history of a song. I think previously we did one about Give Peace a Chance long, long ago. Anyway, so I'm delighted to welcome James to the podcast. And the place to begin really is by examining the actual composer of the song. And that's our starting point. So firstly, James, welcome. And I thought perhaps we should dive into, you know, who wrote Amazing Grace and the kind of the context of that and the historical moment that the song was created in.
Amazing Grace has this extraordinary history of going from an English hymn of the late 18th century through to this global anthem. It was written by the Reverend John Newton in the 1770s, first sung January the 1st, 1773. But the curious thing about John Newton is that although by then he was an Anglican vicar, he had been a mariner. Mm-hmm. He'd been a mariner in the Mediterranean, but more especially in the Atlantic. And he'd been the captain of a slave ship. And he had shipped Africans from Africa, enslaved, to the Americas. Mm-hmm. And yet, here is a man mired in the brutality and the horrors, really, of Atlantic slavery, who is best known for writing the words to one of the world's most famous hymns.
And with his sort of involvement as a mariner, to what extent was he, you know, one of the almost the entrepreneurs of the slave trade? He's not simply just, you know, the person that moves things back and forth. Was he's more kind of financially involved in the business of slavery, isn't he?
Well, he's a first mate of a slave ship, then a captain, and he has a vested interest in it. I mean, he doesn't invest his own money in it, but he's a great beneficiary from it. But at the point there is, of course, that there were tens of thousands of people like John Newton in the 18th century, not just Brits, but Europeans and Americans, who for whom the slave trade was a booming business. The curious object, the curious thing about Newton is that a man with such a record turns his face against slavery. Not only turns his face against it, but becomes one of the major advocates of abolition by the last generation in his life. And his lasting memory is, of course, Amazing Grace.
And how do we account for that, that this kind of this change in him? What seems to have led to that?
John Newton had been brought up by a God-fearing mother, and he was a very learned boy and a much-read man, really steeped in literature, but steeped also in scriptures. And there's this curious mix. He emerges as a full-grown man, well-versed in the Bible, well-versed in hymnals. His mother took him to nonconformist churches in the city of London when he was young. And he was really committed to singing, which Baptists and Methodists did, but which the Anglican Church didn't do. And he turns against the institution that he made money from and that was his livelihood. He turns against it slowly and doesn't really come out against it publicly until the 1780s, when he actually writes pamphlets against it and gives evidence before the Privy Council against the slave trade. But before then, what converts him, what makes him see the errors of his ways, is an extraordinary storm in the Atlantic when he was a sailor. And the ship was wrecked, almost lost. They limp into Ireland and then back to Liverpool. And he regards this as salvation. He regards this as the Lord giving him grace. And it fits in with discussions he had already with other people about what is grace? How do you secure grace? How do you secure a guaranteed place through the pearly gates? And he's determined, after he falls ill and is no longer able to be able to see, working in Liverpool, he's determined to become a cleric. But that's a very difficult thing to do because he has no formal education. He hasn't been to Oxford or Cambridge, but he's deeply learned. And after five efforts, he's finally enrolled into the Church of England. He's finally given a clerical position. Mm-hmm. And that is in the parish church in Olney in Buckinghamshire.
Yeah.
And in Olney in Buckinghamshire, where he makes friends with Cooper, the great poet, they write hymns together. Newton is a great believer that hymns are a good way of worshipping. He's certainly influenced by the Methodists in this.
Yeah.
And he tries to write hymns that will support a particular extract from the Bible, a particular sermon he's given. And Amazing Grace is written for one of those. It's simply to back up what he preached that particular day. But it's designed for the poor people of Olney, his poor parishioners. He becomes such a great preacher that they have to extend the meeting rooms in Olney to make room for large crowds. And they listen to this great preacher, once a slave trader, and in 1773 they hear Amazing Grace and they sing Amazing Grace. But they don't sing it the tune that we're familiar with today. That doesn't come until really much later.
Mm-hmm. And was he in his sort of second life as a member of the clergy, was he fairly kind of explicit about his past as a slave mariner, or did he sort of tend to kind of avoid that?
Newton actually covers up some of his past deeds. He recognizes the sinfulness and the wickedness of his ways, but he doesn't like to spell that out. We know, for instance, from his journals, from his diaries, that he did what any other slave captain would do. He brutalizes Africans. For instance, he puts them in the thumb schools if he thinks that there is a potential revolt brewing on board ship.
Mm.
Remember, the Africans are they hugely outnumber the crew. And they are a great threat to every slave ship. You have to keep them shackled. You have to keep an eye on them. Grant them a moment's freedom and they're at your throat. And he actually puts Africans in a thumb screw to get them to confess to organizing a rebellion, which is commonplace on slave ships. That's the kind of past that he doesn't really want to spell out. As much as he denounces it, and indeed he does talk in general terms about people putting the Africans in the thumb screen. But he never says, I did it. He never says, my great wickedness has been to brutalize Africans. He doesn't say that. Mm. He just said, it's not uncommon for it to happen.
Mm. Yeah. And no doubt there was immense shame that he carried with him throughout much of the rest of his life. Where does he fit in? I know there was a kind of like a fictionalized account of this. There was a film made, in fact, called Amazing Grace, probably about 20 years ago now, with kind of aspects of this story in it. In the kind of like the pantheon of English abolitionists, is he a significant figure, or is it his kind of role not to be sort of overplayed, really?
I think you can overstress it, but I mean, what we mustn't do is to forget the role he played. And we don't have many men who actually are recognized by the highest politicians and statesmen in the land as significant figures in speaking up against the slave trade who had been slave traders. I mean, his key role, it's almost a unique role in a way, that he knew the story from the inside. He had been a slave captain. He bought and sold Africans. He knew precisely what he was talking about. And that makes him a kind of invaluable witness. From 1787, the Privy Council begins to take evidence about the slave trade in the campaign that Wilberforce was orchestrating, they turn to him because his voice has a kind of authority which no one else has. I mean, anyone could stand up and denounce it on moral or theological grounds, but who else had actually been at the grim end of it, of buying them, selling them, beating them, and holding them in awe as they crossed the Atlantic? Well, John Newton had. So, in a way, he is a kind of unique voice in a world where there are very, very few leads of that kind.
Right. And during his lifetime, did the song of Amazing Grace kind of spread beyond his own immediate kind of congregation? Was it something that was kind of popularized in his lifetime, or not so much?
I think he went to his grave in 1807, unaware of the pretension of his hymn. It certainly hadn't spread in England, and indeed it stayed in the background in England for a long time. The place where it actually does take root and become something quite different is the New Republic of the United States. It's published in the United States, first of all, I think, in 1789, if I remember rightly. And thereafter, it spreads. And it spreads because the United States, the early United States, becomes a very religious place. And the extraordinary proliferation of Christian churches and Christian preachers, of traveling preachers, all of whom, like English Methodists before them and the Moravians, use music to promote their interests. And one of the things they use is the hymn that John Newton wrote. That's one of many. It's not the only one, but Amazing Grace finds a place in the kind of lexicon of American church music very early on in the early 19th century.
And is it understood at the time? I mean, is any of the history of the song understood at the time? Because obviously, if it's in America, it's being popularized in a totally different context of slavery and arguments for abolition. Yes. Was it used for, you know? Was it particularly an abolitionist hymn initially in the first part of the 19th century?
It isn't really. Amazing Grace takes root, first of all, as a kind of folk song in the backwoods of the United States. English, Welsh, Scottish and Irish immigrants sing Amazing Grace as part of their very vibrant folk culture, and they sing it to various tunes. But the key element in all this is the way it takes root in African-American communities. It takes root amongst the slaves. And if you read the words, you can see why. The words of Amazing Grace have an extraordinary resonance for African-American, particularly for enslaved people. You look at the third verse. Through many dangers, toils and snares, we have already come. 'Twas grace has brought us safe thus far, and grace will lead us home. You know, there's a verse that speaks directly to the bitter lot of the millions of African Americans who were enslaved before 1860.
Yeah. And so that's really interesting, isn't it, about how a text, if you will, finds a kind of a particular meaning at a particular moment with a particular group of people. And you know, you can go off into a kind of cultural studies sort of journey there, but there are frequent examples of the texts resonating, songs resonating with people in all sorts of perhaps unexpected ways.
Yes.
So you carry on. Sorry, James.
If you think with American Amazing Grace takes root amongst the enslaved, then thrives amongst the freed African-American communities, especially when they move out of the South to the big cities of the North and the Midwest. It's in those churches that Amazing Grace becomes part of African-American gospel. And the great gospel singers of the late 19th, early 20th century, right down to the great gospel singers that we're all familiar with, and Mahalia Jackson, they all sing Amazing Grace. And it's a direct route back to slave days and a direct route back to that third verse that John Newton wrote, in a way, in All Innocence of Slavery, despite being a slave captain of the slave.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Right, right. And so, yeah, to talk about that, you know, you this song takes us on this journey from the late 18th century, obviously, through all the way through to the America's 19th century, which is kind of truncated in the middle by a civil war over slavery. And then there is this period, this kind of Reconstruction period, and which, you know, falters, and then there's a kind of a recrudescence of white supremacism in the last part of the 19th and early part of the 20th century. And so when at a certain point, the kind of Amazing Grace becomes, it becomes like a gospel song, and I'm guessing probably sung predominantly by black gospel choirs as opposed to white people.
Well, there are parallel lines of this story. It becomes a striking song, a striking hymn in black churches, and particularly part of African-American gospel. But it's also sung by huge numbers of very influential white gospel singers and in white churches. And it continues as well as a popular song, rather than a hymn, amongst folk singers. And what happens in the 20th century is that these two strands emerge into something quite different with the commercialization of recorded and broadcast music to become the extraordinary popular hymn, first of all in the United States and then globally. But in the case of African American life, the hymn becomes one of those hymns that actually accompanies African American politics and African American protests. When African Americans begin to campaign for civil rights, well, they always campaign for them. But when that campaign reaches a new level in the years after the Second World War, when people march, they sing, amongst other hymns, they sing "Amazing Grace." We Shall Overcome. They sing "Amazing Grace," and they sing it because it is something that they've sung since time out of mind.
Yes. Yes. And so it comes to, as you say, after the Second World War, it comes to be a sort of symbolic of that new phase of struggle. And it's popularized by a number of quite famous people during the civil rights struggle. I think Aretha Franklin sang it. I think so. I could be sang. I could be corrected there, and there are a number of key songs from the 1930s onwards. One that I've talked about previously on here is "Strange Fruit" by Billie Holiday, but "Amazing Grace" seems to have captured that historical moment in a very powerful way.
Yes.
Was it the kind of thing that was sung actually on marches, things like the 1965 Voting Rights Act march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and things like that, or would it normally be sung before, some sort of event beforehand?
It's sung throughout the civil rights campaign, really, from the 60s onwards. And we'll give you just one example. I mean, when Martin Luther King led the great bus boycott march in and from Montgomery, at night, after a very exhausting day, on the road, but also very dangerous, you know, they were threatened and were killed and violated. When he was trying to rest at night, Mahalia Jackson would ring him up and sing "Amazing Grace" to him down the telephone line to help him relax. That's a real interesting insight into the importance of that hymn between those two people and that particular historical moment. And we know that when people were imprisoned on those marches, they sang "Amazing Grace" in prison. And there's this haunting music that accompanies, in a way, it's the kind of the background music to the civil rights campaign. It's not just "We Shall Overcome," which becomes the most strident one and the one that's best remembered. But yeah. "Amazing Grace" is something that actually floats through the whole campaign, right through to the later years when the campaigns against the Vietnam War worked.
Mm-hmm. And does it remain a kind of rooted in kind of a Christian tradition, or does it become sort of more secular in some ways?
Interesting question whether it remains religious or secular, because one of the most important folk singers of the 20th century, Pete Seeger, was an open communist. I mean, he didn't like the idea of singing "Amazing Grace" because he was not a believer and thought it was too Christian, too religious. But when he looked at the words have a humane impact, a sense. I mean, that third verse, for instance, this speaks to the human condition, human aspirations, human suffering. And folk singers picked it up as a secular song.
Yeah,
and so what you have really is a hymn that actually appeals to both sides of the religious divide, those that don't believe at all, but for whom it actually says something about mankind, and those for whom it has kind of spiritual significance.
Yeah.
And then the other fact that comes in is that the music itself is changed. The music itself becomes important because the music from 1971 comes to be played by pipers, by Scottish pipers, with no words attached to it at all. Now, you can't listen to a Scottish bagpiper playing it and say, well, it's the religious side of the song because there are no words to it. It's just the music. So what there are the different strands. There's the secular strand, the religious strand, and then the simple musical seduction of the music.
And you know, I suppose if you were to look at kind of 20th century America and pick out a handful of songs, such as you know, "This Land Is Your Land," the "Amazing Grace," and you know a couple of other kind of key kind of anthems of sort of protest. They, like you said, they're slightly transcendent, aren't they? They're not about, you know, sectarianism or anything else. They're about something more fundamentally human than that. And I note that it was I'm casting my mind back now because it's actually quite a long time ago. But the Obama inauguration, which is one of those things you when you actually remember, you think, oh, that was only a few years ago, and it's not. It's actually a long, long time ago. The Obama inauguration had "Amazing Grace" sung at it, didn't it?
Well, the most important link between Obama and "Amazing Grace" was when he sang it in 2015. He sang it at the funeral of an assassinated minister, the Reverend Pinckney, who was a state senator in South Carolina, and who'd been murdered along with eight of his parishioners at a Bible reading class.
Oh, yes, I see.
Part of the meeting. And Obama went down to do the funeral eulogy and did so in front of a crowd of 5,000 in the College of Charleston basketball stadium, with thousands more outside in the summer sweltering heat. And as he's giving the oration, you can see this on YouTube to this day, it's a spellbinding moment. Obama pauses and suddenly starts to sing "Amazing Grace." Now, with all the best will in the world, we can't say that President Obama's got a good singing voice. But it is an electrifying political moment. The ministers, the clerics around him, struggle to stand up and join him, and the musicians in the room do the same. But what's interesting is that 5,000 people stand up as their president sings, and without the words in front of them, 5,000 people begin to join and sing that they know it word perfect, without it being in the order of service. Now, there's a sign of the significance of the hymn. And Obama singing "Amazing Grace" is one of those kind of key moments in the story of this extraordinary hymn.
And you know, Obama, a kind of a very, very seasoned, very talented political figure, understands the subtext of what he's singing and the message of what he is singing.
What's interesting about that episode is that it looks for all the world as if it's spontaneous. In fact, he discussed it beforehand with his wife and with his close advisors, and they all thought it's a bad idea. Don't do it. Don't sing. You can't sing. And he thought if the congregation was with him, and how could they not be, African-American, largely audience, and an African-American president, if they were with him, it would be okay for him to sing. And of course, it was a brilliant, audacious political coup.
And that is the kind of thing that sort of political moments are made of, aren't they? You know, a bit of chance, a bit of judgment, a bit of fingers crossed, and you know, and it doesn't fall flat on its face. But it's a kind of like an interesting sort of bookend to the story. Anyway, I'm sure "Amazing Grace" will continue to be used in all sorts of different ways, but it's fascinating to observe the song's origins all the way through it to it being sung by the first African American president of the United States.
Well, it's the in terms of the book I've written about Amazing Grace, that moment in 2015 is what persuaded me to write the book. I'd been curious about John Newton and about the hymn because I'd been a choir boy myself between 1948 and 1960, but we never sang Amazing Grace. This was an Anglican church in North Manchester. Mm-hmm. And it was only really living in the United States, working on slavery and slave trade for earlier books, that you can't avoid Amazing Grace when you're in the United States.
Yeah.
Then that moment in 2015, seeing Obama sing it and seeing the response, I thought, there's a story behind this. There's a story to be told. And that's what persuaded me to write the book.
Well, while we're talking about the book, obviously, you know, I always make sure that there is a kind of an appropriate moment to plug the book a little bit. Currently available in all good bookshops?
It comes out in late November.
Right.
Published November the 22nd.
Okay, so what we'll do is I'll see if there's a means of pre-ordering it to put a link into the podcast. If not, I'll do a reminder around the time. And obviously, to listeners every week, if you want to order the book, please support your local bookshop, your independent bookshop. Amazon are too rich by half, but make sure your independent bookshop is supported if you can do, please. Okay, well, we shall finish there, James. But firstly, thank you so much for your time. I'm very, very grateful to have been able to talk about Amazing Grace there. It would be a pleasure if you're available in the future to talk about related matters if you'd like to return and have a chat.
I enjoyed doing that. Thank you very much for asking me.
Okay, super. Well, we'll finish there, and thanks so much, and all the best. Good luck with the book.
Thanks again. Take care.
Bye-bye. Cheers.